From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, August 18th, 2017. And on this day, the ACLU draws criticism, good news for loons, and in our series on disappearing trades in Maine, we'll visit a printer. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
The American Civil Liberties Union and its affiliates, including in Maine, are under fire from some of their own supporters. The staunch defender of free speech and other constitutional rights is being criticized because it gave legal support to a white nationalist group in its efforts to rally in a Charlottesville park. Fred Bever has more.
Around the country and on the Facebook page of the Maine chapter of the ACLU, members are speaking out. Portland resident Ella Mock asked the ACLU, quote, "When will the Nazi rally in Portland be? When will you fight for one of my friends to be killed?" Reached by phone, Mock said she's been making monthly contributions to the ACLU since the presidential election. But in the wake of the Charlottesville violence, Mock says she will end her membership.
To know that I have funded in part this activity is pretty terrifying, honestly. I have many, many friends whose lives and well-being I fear for due to this action.
Mock also says she was chagrined that on the same Facebook page that cited the group's support for the supremacist group's right to rally, the ACLU of Maine posted its condemnation of flyers distributed in the Booth Bay area this week that purported to recruit for the Ku Klux Klan.
The simple irony and hypocrisy that their last two posts on Facebook are, oh, let's cry out against these KKK flyers being distributed, and, oh, well, we have to stand by this free speech of white nationalists is pretty appalling.
Another Portland resident who was arrested last year in a Black Lives Matter protest, Albert Briggs, called the ACLU a tool being used to spread a deadly message.
When it supports the right to promote genocide openly by a group of, you know, violent people, I would say that they're not using their power for the right thing.
Briggs notes this isn't the first time the ACLU, founded in 1920, has been criticized for defending hate speech. And the organization's position on Nazi ideology in particular dates back to 1934, when an internal debate on the question ended with a decision to defend Nazis' rights to free speech. Similar debates have broken out periodically ever since.
We just need to recognize freedom of everyone's speech all the time, unless it is inciting violence.
That's Andy Schmidt, a Portland lawyer who took to Facebook to defend the ACLU's stance. He says that liberal-minded ACLU members would be wise to support most public speech because otherwise government officials may be left to define what is or isn't permissible.
I think in another time, I can imagine everyone wanting to just shut down hate speech, but right now we need to be very cognizant that the people deciding what is hate speech are going to be Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump and the Republicans in Congress, and what they see as hate speech is going to be very, very different than what many of the ACLU's critics think of as hate speech.
Local ACLU officials did not make themselves available for an interview. One ACLU staffer in Maine, Rachel Healy, emailed Thursday that there is, quote, a lot of internal discussion and soul searching going on right now. In a later email, the executive director of the ACLU's Maine chapter, Allison Bie, says the First Amendment should not be used as cover for violence, and she says that the ACLU, quote, will no longer represent groups seeking to march with firearms when it is reasonable to believe there will be violence at their gatherings. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
The Portland-based Biodiversity Research Institute is reporting a development that could have broad implications for efforts to protect loons. A loon chick that was relocated from Maine to a lake in Massachusetts last summer has returned to its second home, not the lake where it was born. And as Susan Sharon reports, that is raising hopes that loons could be restored to their former breeding range.
For the past 3 years, biologists from BRI have taken 17 loons from healthy loon populations in northern New York State and Maine and transported them to southeastern Massachusetts, where loons vanished more than a century ago. It's part of an experiment approved by the state and federal government to try to restore loons to places that they once lived. Once relocated, the loon chicks are raised in a submerged pen on the new lake for several weeks. This was a chick from Maine known as Number 6, being evaluated, weighed, measured, and banded by biologist Alex Dalton and a volunteer before his release to his new home last summer.
You see how I'm holding him? I've got his head tucked under my arm here.
I do, yeah.
And so I'm gonna plop him in your lap.
Yep.
And if you just hold on kind of like this, that gives you control over the wings and the legs.
Okay.
The goal is to get the loon chicks to imprint on the lake before they take their first flight during fall migration. Typically, young loons will spend several years in the ocean before returning home. But this year, something unexpected happened. A young loon from Maine came back a year early, and it returned to the lake in Massachusetts. BRI's executive director, Dave Evers, says it was spotted earlier this week.
So we were pretty excited to see that this is working. We're raising loon chicks in a certain area, release them to the wild, and a year later, here they come back to the lake.
Evers says restoring bird species in this manner is considered an accepted conservation practice. It's previously been done with peregrine falcons, trumpeter swans, and whooping cranes. But this is the first time translocation has been done successfully with a common loon. And Evers says it marks a big moment for loon conservation, since loons are faithful in returning to lakes where they were hatched, even though there could be quality habitat for them 30 or 40 miles away.
We're jump-starting the population in Massachusetts, where right now the breeding population is about 44 pairs. We're hoping that loons return, and now we do know they return. And then the next step is waiting for those returning loons to set up shop and start breeding and establish a population in that area.
The experiment is part of a broader project called Restore the Call that is also underway in several western states and Minnesota. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
These days, when people say they're sending a document to the printer, they usually mean they're sending it over to the Xerox machine. It has never been easier to duplicate a stack of signs, letters, or notices, but that's a pretty new thing. In our latest installment of Once Upon a Job, Jennifer Mitchell introduces us to a printer who is still proud of his old-fashioned letterpress and won't do things any other way.
Dennis J. Watson has decided to resist the computer age.
I enjoy the old technology. Never turned on one computer yet in my life.
He says he had a close call with a microwave oven once, but that's as high-tech as Watson's lifestyle is likely to get.
My press is 1879 that I run every day. Everything I have to do is know-how. I got to know my math. I got to know my spelling because there's no computer to tell me if there's a mistake.
For Watson, choosing a low-tech lifestyle is almost an act of civil disobedience.
Technology has taken too many jobs away from people, and it's taken more, and I don't like seeing that happen.
Letterpress printing has its roots in the 15th century, when Johannes Gutenberg fashioned a printing device out of a modified wine press. It used a system of movable type, itself dating to ancient China, where each letter or symbol exists as a separate piece that can be placed where it's needed. This is called typesetting, and printers like Watson do it manually for each word, line, and page they need to print.
This is where all my typesetting is done. Wooden cabinets. And it's all individual letters.
Watson opens specialized chests of drawers. Each tray holds a particular style of font and point size. Within each font tray, compartments hold a multitude of small lead pieces. And on the end of each piece is the raised relief of a single letter, punctuation mark, or a blank spacer.
And it's not in alphabetical order. It goes according to what you use, what letter you use the most. Like up here is your letter E. It's the biggest compartment in your whole typesetting drawer.
To make a word or a sentence, Watson picks up what's called a composing stick, sort of a handheld rack that he fills with letters and spaces in the right order, which he tightens into place with miscellaneous bits. The letters all appear to him in mirror image. Watson is pretty good at reading this way. He has to be, since there's no delete key on a printing press. But he takes the stick over to a small manual press designed for further proofreading.
And I roll it through the press like that. And I have something that I can look at, a print, that I can look at it and see what's if there's any misspellings, I proofread it.
When he's happy with the setting, he takes the prepared type to the printing room where he locks it all in place. The round plate on the 140-year-old printer is inked, and he's ready to go. As the machine gapes open, Watson swiftly places a piece of card inside. The machine bites down and then opens up just long enough for him to simultaneously pull out the stamped card and slide another in its place.
So you seem to really get into a rhythm.
You do. You gotta keep track of your hand. There's not much room. You can actually get your fingers in the wrong spot. You gotta be careful you don't do it.
Watson learned the business from his father, who had gone to work at Burr Printing in 1941. He started out as the perpetually ink-covered printer's devil, the person responsible for sweeping floors and scrubbing equipment. Eventually, he took over the business. And despite the rise of offset, photo, and digital printing, Watson says there's been something of a revival for letterpress.
When you touch a photocopy, it's flat print. When you touch mine, you can actually feel the embossing right into the paper. And people like that.
Wedding invitations, cards for antique dealers, and product labels for local produce are keeping him busy. But even though the business is doing well, Watson has had to think about his future. He's in his 60s now.
I'm getting towards your retirement age. And this past year, I sold it to Bangor Letter Shop. They didn't want to see this letterpress printing die out. I think they are going to carry this on.
Watson remains on the payroll as the new letterpress expert, and he may soon have a printer's devil of his own. Preston Nickerson, who runs the offset printer, says he's ready to go old school.
I'm going to try. Hopefully I'll come back with all my fingers.
Are you all up on your spelling and your math and your grammar?
Absolutely not. I'll be spell checking on Google or on my phone while I'm doing it. No problem.
For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Friday, August 18th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.